All right, I know the weather is not that great, so I will try and wrap it up close before 5, let's put it that way. Okay, so continuing the series of lectures, today I'm going to be talking about cancer imaging and radiology. And one of the things at the outset I will say as a consolation for if you get overwhelmed is we're going to be covering a lot of ground, and a lot of these topics are actually semester-long courses. I was just talking to one of the students. We have an entire semester on MRI. We have an entire semester NMR, other techniques. So it's okay if you feel, what I'm trying to go in, at least what I hope to accomplish is give you the basics that you know that something about if you end up using it for your thesis research or even if you're going to have a conversation about it. But feel free to either stop me during the lecture or email, phone, want to stop by and talk more or want to have a tour of my lab, whatever you want. Just feel free to approach me. And particularly with some of the imaging methods, it's not easy to just intuitively grab things. So don't feel you're alone at this. Okay, so I always like starting off with the simple things, just almost to recall what you think intuitively in terms of images or imaging, right? So what is an image? Put your handouts away for a second. What is an image? What is an image in your mind? Do you have a definition for an image? Like, what do you think is an image? So, are these images? So, what's the first one's? It's a picture of a bus, right? Is that an image? And then, what about this one? It's a thumbprint, right? And this one, barcode. So, what do you think conceptually? Do you guys have? We all see things all the time, right? We have. So one of the things that I wanted to point out is we are constantly visualizing things. So imaging, in that sense, is happening all around you all the time, right? We'll talk about specific kinds of imaging. That's an X-ray. That's a dental X-ray. This is a barcode. That's also technically an image. And here's an example. This is actually Dr. Roswell Park. So in the simplest of sense, an image is basically an array of pixels. You probably have heard of the term pixels, right? So if you look at it, I just simplified it. If you look at rows and columns of that same image, right, you see basically squares. You see pixels. That's really what makes up an image. It's an array of rows and columns of these pixels or picture elements. And what is really a pixel? It's really a unit of information. That's what it is. A pixel is a constitutive element of a digital image. And how many pixels you have in an image in the X and Y determines what's the dimension of that pixel. The reason I'm starting off with this is before we talk about different imaging modalities, I want you guys to at least recall, if you don't already know, or perhaps get familiar with basic terms, imaging terms. Resolution. If I say resolution, does that mean anything to you as of this point? This is really cool. I know it's late afternoon, but I need to know where you guys are at so I can actually either scale up or scale down. What's resolution, do you know? Resolution, have you heard the term resolution? So we'll go into the details, and I'm going to try and break it down in terms of certain things that I know most of you are familiar with. So when you talk about pixel dimensions, right, think of pixels, as I mentioned, as a unit of information. How many pixels went into an image influences the image, and of course the size of the image file. Here's an example of resolution, spatial resolution particularly. So anytime you hear resolution, it could be temporal resolution, which is the number of events that you could probably capture in time. We won't get into that. Spatial resolution is what most people refer to, which is essentially the dimensions of that image or the number of elements that went into actually making that image. So in terms of a simple formula, the resolution of an image is the pixel dimensions over the physical dimensions of that image. And so here's an example. If the image dimension is 10 by 7.5 inches and the pixel dimension is 720 by 540, what is the resolution of the image? It's not a trick question. The answer is in front of you. There you go. So you may have heard the term DPI. That's dots per inch or PPI, pixels per inch. That's essentially trying to define what the resolution or the level of detail in your image is. So this is, again, I'm trying to start with the basics. We'll get into the individual methods as we go along. So as I just mentioned, you've all printed lectures. your favorite papers, your PowerPoint presentations, right? Remember, whenever you try, you go to a printer, it tells, you know, what DPI do you want it to be printed. That's essentially the unit. The printer, for example, the output in a printer is typically DPI, which is dots per inch, or even your monitor. If you have a flat screen monitor, you have a TV, it says this is the resolution, this is the dimension of that screen, right? That's what we're referring to. And DPI, of course, is slightly different because multiple dots can make up a pixel. That's another level of detail. But at least recognize, at least understand conceptually, what is an image, what is a pixel, what is resolution, and when we talk about resolution across modalities, what we mean by that is typically spatial resolution, and look at the level of detail that you would need in a certain image in order to capture. Okay, I'm giving you a simpler example. I'm sure most of you have smartphones. A lot of you probably have iPhone 6 as an example. Digital cameras, if you remember, probably 5 or 6 years ago, I think my first camera was like a 3 megapixel, and that was a big deal 8 years ago, right? Now the camera has an 8 megapixel on the phone. What does it really mean? What does a megapixel really mean? It's a million pixels. It's exactly what the term implies, right? But what does that mean in terms of the image or the quality of the images that we get? So as a basic concept of resolution, if you wanted a certain resolution in an image, there's a maximum size you can print given a number of pixels or megapixels. So here's actually a table. So if you had a 2 megapixel camera, let's say, and if you wanted to print images at 300 ppi, that's the maximum size, the 3x2 print size that you can go by. So I took the example of an iPhone 6, which has an 8 megapixel camera. So at 300 ppi, you can print that 3x2, you can print up to 11.5 by 7 points. Immediately you get the senses to basically, the more the units of information, the greater detail you're capturing, and therefore the higher resolution of your image. That's the if nothing else you remember from these slides, at least recognize that. Okay, here's an example, hopefully it'll illustrate you better. This is actually an example of what's called a vascular cast. You inject this resin into a mouse, any living animal, and it actually solidifies inside, and you excise the tissues and you actually get high resolution images. So this is a vascular cast of a kidney. That's a 512 by 512 resolution image. And the other thing that you might want to remember is magnifying does not increase the resolution. So the fact that you are trying to click on that plus sign in Windows and trying to zoom it bigger and bigger does not change the resolution of that image. So here's what a 512 by 512 looks like. If you go down to 256, and I don't know if you can appreciate this, you can already see certain loss of detail. You go to 128 by 128, 64 by 64. If you go down to 8x8 and then 4x4, now you can actually see that it's basically, there's no detail there, right? So hopefully now this helps you better understand the idea of resolution, pixels, pixel dimension, and how it influences image quality. And the reason that is important is the idea that we have multiple imaging modalities for a certain reason, because they all vary in resolution, sensitivity, cost, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about it. But here's a simple exercise. How many of these images do you recognize? I'm going to just start walking and stand right next to you and point out, like, whose line is it? I'm going to pull you out and say, what do you think? What do you think this image is? MRI, okay. What about this one? You guys are whispering. Speak up, please. X-ray, okay. What's the third one? It's okay if you don't know all of it, right? That's the point of the lecture. Why don't you just write it down in your handout? We'll revisit this at the end of the lecture. But at this point, you guys have MR for this and X-ray for this. Any takers for these two? No answers? Okay, which is fine. We'll revisit this at the end of the lecture, as I mentioned. Okay, so we talked about the basics of image, essentially 101 of imaging, right? What I wanted to show you was basically where we've come, or the path that we've come. So going from the early 1900s, when X-ray was first discovered, since then, and this is almost close to a decade old now, we've gone through a whole lot of development, engineering developments, that have translated into us discovering, developing new imaging methods. So you have ultrasound, PET came in, then MRI comes in, CT, in an ultrasound, interventional ultrasound. And then, of course, in the 2000s, we started combining methods. So dual modality, multimodality imaging methods, and then even functional imaging methods, which we'll talk about. And so this is, of course, in the clinical realm. A lot of this is actually being used clinically. And also in the, let's say, preclinical or even the microscopy realm, there have been other things. So microscopy is also a form of imaging, right? I'm sure a lot of you use microscopy routinely in your research. So, for example, if you look at the same timeline, whether you're looking at in vivo optical imaging methods, bioluminescence, fluorescence, which we'll talk about, or microscopic methods, bright field, epifluorescence methods, confocal, for example, all of these are different kinds of imaging methods. And back to my first point, the reason why we need all these is because no one imaging method can give you everything. They all have strengths and weaknesses, and we'll talk about that. Okay, so here's the first overview of what I mean by that when I say there are multiple methods, right? This lists not everything, but at least the big clinically used imaging methods. PET, SPECT, optical imaging, ultrasound, MR, CT. We'll talk about PET, MRI, ultrasound, and optical. In the interest of time, we can't cover a lot of ground in all of them, but I'm more than happy to talk to you if you have specific questions about any of the imaging methods. But one of the points that I made before that you can see in the table across the imaging methods is, first up, they all vary in spatial resolution. The degree of, you know, detail that you can get between these methods, as you can see, you have MRI and CT, for example, can be high resolution, whereas PET or SPECT is much lower resolution, spatial resolution. But optical imaging, for example, can give you resolution, but it's also influenced by depth based on the light penetration, which we'll talk about. So as I mentioned, for most of the clinical imaging methods, except for the optical imaging, depth is not an issue, given the biophysical basis for these other methods is not light, which is usually what determines the penetration of light determines the kind of imaging you can get, data sets you can gather, but also across other parameters, the sensitivity, the amount of external tracers, exogenous contrast agents that you would need, it varies. So you go from nanograms to micrograms to gram quantity level of contrast, what we call contrast enhancing agents. So methods can give, a lot of these methods, as we will talk about, can rely on endogenous contrast methods. So things that are actually in tissue, could be hemoglobin, could be melanin, or we inject a tracer, we inject a dye, and then look at the kinetics of the dye in order to better get a handle on what kind of tissues that we're imaging. So we'll talk a little bit all about that. But before that, I also wanted to recall or remind you, why do we use imaging? Why do we use images in medicine, or particularly in oncology, right? So if you take the clinical paradigm, the classic paradigm, patient presents with a certain complaint, maybe a symptom of a certain thing, or just a presenting complaint. So in this case, this is a patient with a lesion in the tongue, and then we go through a battery of diagnostic tests, among which is imaging, right? There's also, maybe if it's a lesion that needs to be biopsied, we looked at the pathologic characteristics of that tissue as well, and this doesn't project well, but basically there's a staging system where we use a combination of clinical presentation, radiologic exam, and pathologic examination to identify or diagnose the disease and diagnose and stage the disease. This is as cancer is concerned. And then, of course, we decide on the management, if it's going to be surgery or chemotherapy or radiation or some kind of targeted therapeutic. So this is why historically, if you look at radiology, it was always perceived as diagnostic radiology, meaning it's a tool that helps you arrive at the diagnosis of a certain disease, right? And there's also, since then, of course, we'll talk about how the field's changed or changing. This is also used as a screening tool for clinically occult cancer. So perhaps high-risk population CT screening, for example. Mammography is another example, right? Where you don't necessarily have a diagnosis, but we want to see if everything's well, right? So that's another application of imaging. In radiation oncology, radiation medicine, which is a branch of oncology, where tumors are irradiated, as I mentioned before, imaging actually has a role to play in what we call treatment planning. We actually can, if you look at the scan, this is actually a brain tumor in a patient. The images are used to identify what needs to be irradiated, and actually helps us design treatments that are hopefully selective or at least targeted to the tumor with minimal exposure radiation to the surrounding normal tissues. So now it's actually playing a role in your treatment planning. And the goal, of course, is always based on the individual patient anatomy. You have a target dose that you want to accomplish for the tumor, or what you want to achieve, make sure the tumor gets exposed to that dose while making sure organs at risk, surrounding tissues, perhaps major vessels, they don't get exposed to that same dose. So in other words, you actually can now modulate the exposure of that radiation to your tumor versus hopefully minimizing exposure to the normal tissue. So this actually tells you, helps you, in which imaging helps you identify a treatment volume that you actually want to use for your treatment planning itself for the radiation therapy. Okay, and then in drug development in oncology, if you look at the pipeline for drug development, going from, let's say, an in vitro assay that you did, you identified a new drug that is going to be the next big drug for cancer, going all the way from that in vitro observation to in vivo, all the way to clinical, phase 1-2 randomized trials to FDA approval, imaging actually has a role to play in every phase of that step, of that process. So in vitro could be something as simple as identifying certain targets. And then, of course, if you're looking at screening, you want to look at efficacy, perhaps. You want to look at biodistribution, maybe in preclinical models, animal models. It could be useful for that in that drug discovery process. And then, of course, even clinical trials in humans, looking at efficacy, looking at safety, perhaps even trying to adjust the dose based on what the imaging data shows as the biological activity of these agents. Okay, so when I mentioned oncology, I mentioned diagnostic radiology, right? The other aspect of it is what we use imaging for is to actually assess. Once we have diagnosed, staged, put the patient on a certain treatment plan or a treatment combination regimen, we want to see if what's happening to the tumor. And the way we do it is by imaging. And so the most commonly used criteria, and even this has been modified a couple of times, is what we call RECIST criteria. And it stands for Response Evaluation Criteria in Solid Tumors. And what it is basically a ruler measurement, if you will, a cross-sectional measurement of the size of that tumor or a target lesion before and after. And then you look at it and decide. It's a very straightforward, simple method that tells you how big the tumor was, let's say at baseline, prior to treatment, then post-treatment, what happened. So a couple of things can happen, right? Tumor either stays the same, goes up, goes down, or completely disappears. Essentially, your criteria for response is then based on this. So for example, obviously, complete response would be disappearance of all target lesions, and the other extreme would be progressive disease when there's actually increase in the tumor from what was at baseline. So what it tells you is now it gives you an idea whether or not patient and slash that tumor is actually responding to your treatment or not. So the nice thing is it's a very simple, straightforward measure, as I said, and it's probably one of the most common measures of efficacy that's used across certainly solid tumor oncology. So great. So what's the problem? The problem is, I'm sure you guys are familiar with this from your first semester, is this, and this is a simplified version of what's happening in a cell, right? A cancer cell. All these molecular changes are happening, and this should be familiar to you guys. If you look at the hallmarks of cancers, there are a lot of characteristics that are happening, but what that knowledge has actually led us is to actually try and target those hallmarks. So I'll give you some specific examples. So for example, you know, the ability to induce angiogenesis is a hallmark of cancer. Tumors start making their own blood vessels after a certain point, right? We've now developed agents that can target that. So now we have anti-angiogenic agents. So there are agents that actually, so certain proliferative signals, epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR, is a driver of certain cancers. We now have anti-EGFR inhibitors. So what it tells you is for every hallmark that we've identified based on our insight into cancer biology, we are trying to exploit it for therapeutic benefit. And so this is no longer from, you know, 30, 40 years ago when every patient who walked in got the same exact treatment combination no matter what the tumor is changing. Maybe not as fast as we would like, but it's certainly changing. Which brings me to the issue that we face is now we don't know. I always say, my personal opinion, we are great at making drugs. there's probably a new drug that we want to make every day, right? Where we really are struggling with is identifying who to give it to. So if the notion is precision medicine, that's what was called personalized medicine, is now, I think what's a more appropriate term is precision medicine, is to say patient A, based on the molecular profile of this tumor, should be on this therapy. Patient B, based on the molecular profile of this tumor, should not be on that therapy, but perhaps something else that targets whatever is driving the cancer. So when you say that, that's easier said than done. So patient selection becomes a problem. And then I mentioned RECIST criteria. That is a simple ruler-based measurement, right? A lot of these drugs, as it turns out, they actually don't necessarily induce an overnight change in size, which means that becomes an issue. So what kind of an endpoint assessment that we use? So here's another way of looking at it. This is a simplified cartoon of four pathways that are known pathways that are oncogenic, right? Driving pathways in certain cancers. For virtually every pathway, if you look at any one of these, there are drugs that either target the intracellular domain, the tyrosine kinase domains, or extracellularly competingly bind. It's an antibody against that particular receptor. So for every level, and not to mention downstream signals, in a simplified version, there's probably 30 drugs listed there that are all targeted therapies, right? Trying to address or target a specific signaling pathway within the cancer, which then means, how do we assess? Not all of them might cause a change in size. And so it raises the question, is RECIST actually good enough? And when I say good enough, for what? So first thing we know, and this is our understanding of the modern, what we call target therapeutics versus the traditional chemotherapeutics, the DNA damaging agents, is they tend to be cytotoxic, whereas a lot of these targeted drugs are cytostatic, meaning they may not cause a dramatic reduction in size of the tumor overnight, but that doesn't mean they're not hitting the target, right? So a ruler-based measurement does not account for that particular molecular change that's happening in response to treatment. Again, this is another given. We know tumors are heterogeneous, right? This is one of the difficulties in treating them. Not every patient, two patients even with the same tumor, exact same stage, are molecularly different. So the heterogeneity is not exactly captured when you just do a ruler measurement cross-sectional. Two lesions that are same size yet could be completely different molecularly. So that becomes an issue. And then typically the readout, the endpoint of RECIST is often a change in the size, right? So in order to actually have that effect, first of all, that whether or not that's an indicator of biological activity is a question based on what I just told you. Second thing, it's oftentimes it's a late cumulative effect that happens much further down. But so think of it in terms of if I was a patient in, let's say, sixth or seventh decade of my life, and I get diagnosed with advanced stage cancer, I go on a targeted therapy, right? I would want to know if that treatment's going to work or not yesterday, right? Instead of putting me on a treatment regimen that, let's say, maybe 6 months from now that you'll know if it's responding or if I'm responding to that or not, that's precious time lost. So in order to be confident in your decision-making process to say, you know what, there's a pretty good chance that so let's say they profile a tumor that I have and that's not driven by EGFR. There's no point in putting me on an anti-EGFR therapy. So then now you get into the issue of, as particularly for patients with non-responsive tumors, it has a significant impact on potentially being able to put them on treatments that they could actually respond to. So that makes a huge difference in patients' lives. So think of it that way. So the clinical need is knowing early on, maybe after two cycles of therapy, can you tell me if my cancer is going to respond to that or not? That would be a valuable insightful information. So the early response indicators, and this is why there's a whole field of imaging-based biomarkers that's actually currently in development. And so what this has also led to is actually the birth, and this is more than a decade old now, is the whole field of molecular imaging, where the idea is to actually visualize and characterize biological processes. Again, what I mentioned initially, the classic diagnostic radiology paradigm is measuring the size of the tumor. It's anatomic imaging in the simplest sense. But we're moving away from that. We recognize tumors are complex, heterogeneous. We want functional imaging, right? We want functional readouts of the tumor biology. So that's really what the goal of it is. Of course, it could be 2D or 3D. But one of the things that I want to impress upon you is that this is a culmination of multiple fields. It's an interdisciplinary endeavor. If you look, there are molecular biologists, there's physicists, MRI, optical, radionuclides, there's chemistry involved. All of that is what really makes up this field of molecular imaging. So what do I mean by molecular imaging or functional molecular imaging? Again, going back to the hallmarks of cancer, the simplest measure, the ruler measure would be just size. How big was the length and width? That's the assessment, right? Functional imaging would mean, so for example, metabolic activity, is a functional readout of the tumor. Hypoxia, oxygenation, is a measure of the microenvironment of the tumor. Same thing with angiogenesis, which is vasculature. So you can see each of these readouts or characteristics can be measured by multiple techniques, each of which have their own advantages and disadvantages. Apoptosis, you can look at metastatic dissemination, etc. So the point being, we are moving from an anatomic imaging paradigm to a functional imaging, functional molecular imaging paradigm. Okay, so that's the background in terms of imaging and what the potential clinical applications are. I'm going to go through multiple methods, MRI, optical, ultrasound-based methods, and PET. But as I mentioned at the beginning, we're going to cover a lot of ground, so bear with me, but feel free to interrupt if you have anything while I'm going through these. Okay, MRI. How many of you know what an MRI is? Have you had it? Anyone had an MRI before? How was it? What was your experience? Okay. Okay. That's what a scanner looks like. It's essentially a cross section of a scanner, if you will. What is MRI? What does that mean? Okay. So MRI stands for magnetic resonance imaging, and as the name implies, obviously relies on magnetism and resonance. So we'll cover a little bit of what that is. In the simplest sense, the most commonly imaged nuclei are protons. And so MRI, in fact, it used to be called, it relies on the principle of nuclear magnetic resonance. In fact, after this was post-World War II, you can imagine if somebody told you, hey, you need to go get a nuclear MR scan or nuclear magnetic resonance scan. You can immediately see what people would start thinking. So they actually got rid of that, the nuclear part. So it's actually magnetic resonance imaging. It relies on, again, like I said, protons, but it relies on magnetic field in combination with the radio frequency pulse that you apply. Again, these are just examples. Just at the outset, I will say MR probably arguably has the best soft tissue contrast across modalities. So typically, any kind of soft tissue lesions, indications are for an MRI. So to really break it down in terms of the biophysical basis of it, so if you take any given tissue, and of course this is, think of us, right? We're filled with water, protons. So when you go into that scanner, you are putting yourself or your tissues in that magnetic field. What happens is when you do that, your tissues, the protons in your tissue, and this is now, of course, now we're getting into voxels because it's a three-dimensional. So a voxel is a volume element, so it's a 3D pixel. That's what a voxel is, or you could look at it that way. Is now experiencing that magnetic field, and the protons in your tissue will either align with the field or against the field. So for thermodynamic reasons, most of them will actually be the better equilibrium state. Thermodynamic equilibrium demands most of them will actually be in the lower energy state. What we then do is apply that RF pulse to actually excite them. And so they will actually get onto that's why the resonance, the term resonance, comes from applying that frequency of that RF based on the precession of the protons to excite them. And as they relax back, they send out the signal that we get in MR. And this is the absolute watered-down version of it. So in terms of contrast in MRI, a lot of things influence. So here's an example. So what do I mean by contrast? We talked about resolution. Contrast is, again, resolution is the ability to resolve or the detail. Contrast is also the ability in an image to actually look at different tissues based on the way they appear in the image. So for example, in MRI, the contrast is influenced by multiple things. First thing is the proton density, the amount of protons in your body. A simple way to look at it, if you get an MRI of your chest, your lungs will actually appear dark. Because at least in a living human being, you don't have a lot of protons in your lung, right? You don't have a lot of water in your lung. So that'll look dark. So, or for example, if you had a cyst, if you had some kind of a fluid-filled lesion, it's actually going to look brighter. So that's one. That's a simple way of looking at it, but that's one example. Then there's also the environment of the protons and the biological states it's in, and then there are characteristics called T1 and T2 weighting. This relates to what the relaxation characteristics that I mentioned before, and you could actually weight your images to go one way or another in order to get maximum contrast depending on what you're interested in. I'll give you, this is not projecting very well, but I'll give you some more examples. But the idea is you optimize your contrast, your imaging protocol, your pulse sequence as we call it, in order to accomplish that maximum contrast within that tissue of interest. So here's an example. This is again simple anatomic imaging. This is an image of this is the mandible in a human. This is what we call a T1 weighted image. And if you look at it, the arrow is actually pointing to the muscle, and there's actually a soft tissue, there's a tumor there, but you can't quite see it on the T1 weighted image, right? So when you then look at a T2 weighted image, now you have a much better handle on the extent of the lesion. So just by weighting to the different characteristics of the tissue of interest that we're trying to image, you can actually get a much better handle on the extent, in this case, for example, the extent of the tumor. Is it invading muscle? Is it localized? Is there a spread elsewhere, maybe invasion of the bone, et cetera? So you're not able to get a pretty good handle on the delineation of the margins of that tumor. Here's it. So I'm going to go back and forth between. So my lab is interested in imaging. So we're interested in imaging to study cancer biology, to look at drug therapeutic efficacy, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to try to do throughout this is constantly go between preclinical and clinical to give you some flavor of both. So you're able to hopefully connect the dots. So here's an example. So this is in head and neck cancer. It's actually an oral cancer in a patient. We also have mouse models where we used MRI to actually look at progression of disease. So one of the things, as I mentioned before, MRI actually just relies on magnetism and radio frequency. There's no ionizing radiation like some of the other imaging methods. So you can actually do repeated imaging without the risk of exposure to radioactivity or ionizing radiation, and particularly, which is true for most imaging because they're non-invasive, right? Which is a big advantage over biopsy or pathology. When you do a histopathology, you take a section of that tumor, you're never going back to that part of the tumor again because you've just taken it out. Excuse me. So the idea of non-invasive imaging is the ability to allow non-invasively to monitor disease progression or therapeutic response. This is why we always go back to the same scan of the patient. Unlike biopsy, where you can't go back to that particular area because you've already taken it out, you can go back. So here's an example. This is actually in a mouse model where we exposed the mouse to a carcinogen in drinking water. Again, these images are actually, this is a PDF file, I think. Hopefully your handouts are a little bit better than these. But when you look at it over time, week 14, 18, and 26, this is actually a relatively healthy-looking mouse, and this is, of course, a naive mouse that doesn't get exposed. You can track over 14 weeks. Nothing's happening in a healthy mouse, but when you expose it to the carcinogen, you start seeing lesions develop, and this is actually the tongue. Just to anatomically orient you, those are the two eyes. This is what we call an axial section. So if you were looking at the animal, you're taking cross-sections across. So those are the two eyes. That's the brain. These are actually three slices of the animal's head. You can actually see over time you start developing lesions in the tongue, the lateral porters, and there's a tumor that develops. Now you're able to non-invasively monitor disease progression. That's in the clinic. This is preclinical. You can, of course, do this over time and validate it. Again, given that it's non-invasive, you can now look at the tumor. That's clinical exam. That's ex vivo exam. You can take it out and validate it. And then, of course, you could do the pathology biopsy to say that's a invasive squamous cell carcinoma of the tongue. So that's an example of monitoring disease progression using imaging. You can also do, that's anatomic imaging. Just, is there a tumor? How big is the tumor? Measurements of the size. You can also do functional imaging this is one example where we administer an external contrast agent to actually look at in this case, vascular function. Because the tracer is given intravenously, and based on the kinetics of that tracer coming in and out of the tumor, you can now measure how perfused or what's the blood flow, what's the blood permeability or the leakiness of the tumor. So you now get a series of acquisitions. So as the name implies, It's dynamic because you have a dynamic series of images before that you acquire before and after contrast. So it's contrast enhanced. The previous examples I showed you are based on just endogenous contrast, right? Just differences within the tissue, the water content, the way the tumor looks compared to the normal tongue. In this case, you're actually administering an intravenous contrast enhancing agent. You then look at it over time, the kinetics. This is in tumor. You can actually also sample, because you're giving it intravenously, you also want to measure what is the circulating level of contrast agent, because that's what gets to the tumor is a function of what's circulating in the system. So you model both the kinetics of the agent in the tumor and in a blood vessel, a vena cava, for example, and then you can now extrapolate that to multiple parameters. So this is called pharmacokinetic modeling. You're able to model that data, the kinetics of that contrast data, to actually give you information on enhancement patterns that in turn tell you, as I mentioned, blood flow, leakiness of a tumor, and so you get a temporal curve. So for example, this is actually in the blood vessels, for example. When you look at it, obviously the circulating level of the contrast agent is going to be a lot higher than what you see in the tumor. So if you sample the vessel, it'll be a lot higher. Forget the details, but you always want to measure what's circulating and then extrapolate that to the tumor. So here's a simpler version of that. You can actually look at signal intensity, just how much your signal was enhanced. And here's an example. This is in a breast tissue. You could look at the baseline signal at a given time over the increase in signal was after contrast, and it gives you what we call an enhancement image. So this is actually early and late, meaning what time post-injection. So within 5 seconds or within 15 seconds or 2 minutes. And as you can see immediately, just by visually looking at these images, you can tell that the early phase, obviously that lesion's intact, that's a tumor in the breast that's lighting up compared to the surrounding tissue, but you can see over time, it's now leaked, the contrast agent is diffusing out, right? So it's actually leaking out of the tissue. So it's telling you that that tumor, there's actually a lot more leakiness to it, and particularly perhaps the invasiveness of that tumor is a lot higher than what you would have seen just anatomically if you had not used the contrast. You can, of course, quantify it, and you can even come up with patterns to describe what is potentially aggressive disease, what is relatively responsive to therapy. You can also do fancier pharmacokinetic modeling, as I said, the function of what is circulating versus what actually ends up going to the tumor. You can now get what we call parametric maps. The K-trans, for example, is a transfer constant for what's coming out of the vessels. So this is now a leakage map, if you will, permeability map within the tumor. You can also quantify the amount of contrast agent that's actually in the extracellular or the interstitial space. So it tells you the volume of the interstitial space in the tumor based on the kinetics of this. And all of these have actually been looked at in patients, for example. This is all clinical data, obviously, looking at whether or not these are indicators of disease aggression, responsiveness to therapy, perhaps much more indicator of whether or not even your drug. So, for example, if you did have a drug that's targeting the blood vessels of the tumor, you could now use this method to assess whether or not your drug's working. So here's another example of a similar method, same dynamic contrast enhanced MR, but in this case we're looking at nodal disease, the lymph node metastases, which is one of the common sites that head and neck cancers go to. Here are two different lymph nodes. When you look at anatomically, this is contrast enhanced. If you look at anatomic images, perhaps one looks bigger than the other. That's about the most you can observe. But now if you do contrast-enhanced MRI and now get these parametrics maps, you can see, for example, in this upper lymph node on this patient, you can actually see there's a lot more leakiness of that. So this is what we call a pseudo-color. You just impose a pseudo-color on that image so you can get some kind of a quantitative and a visual readout as to the extent of enhancement. So red being more contrast agent and blue being very little contrast agent, you can see the bottom one, for example, there's not a whole lot of enhancement as opposed to the one on top, right? So this is presumably or most likely cystic or necrotic, likely perhaps more aggressive as well, as opposed to the top one that's actually showing quite a bit of active functioning vessels which are actually getting the contrast agent to this lymph node mat. They're also, so we've gone through MRI in terms of diagnosis, disease progression, understanding the biology of the disease. You can also use it to guide interventions. This is an example of image-guided interstitial PDT. PDT stands for photodynamic therapy, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but PDT was actually developed here at Roswell Park. Dr. Thomas Doherty, who was down the hall in MRC first floor, he's the guy who developed this. This is now around the world used as a treatment. It's an FDA-approved treatment for a lot of cancer. So in some ways, you know, you guys think about that. You're part of history. Your graduate education was at a birthplace, just like we have PSA and a couple other discoveries that came here. So PDT, in the simplest sense, what it involves is you inject a dye or a photosensitizer, and then, and this is a cartoon that's showing this, if it's in a patient with head and neck tumor, after a certain amount of time, there is increased, for a lot of biological reasons, increased uptake of this dye in the tumor. That doesn't mean there's no uptake in the normal tissue, but relatively it's a higher level of that sensitizer, and then you locally illuminate that tumor with light in order to generate free radicals. That's the way PDT works. But the problem is a lot of the tumors, particularly head and neck tumors, even this example I gave you, these are pretty big tumors, pretty deep. So in order for PDT to work, you actually want, in order for this sensitizer to be activated and generate free radicals, that light energy actually has to reach a good portion of the tumor. So if you actually just did it from the surface, there's only a certain amount of tumor, part of the tumor that can get illuminated. As opposed to now, interstitially, if you deliver the fiber, the laser fiber, you can get a lot more of that tumor to get treated. So that's the cartoon that's showing here. So what this is now clinically used, and even here we have trials on image-guided interstitial PDT, is the idea is to actually have multiple fibers, laser light fibers, going into the tumor. And this is where imaging comes in. Here's an example. This is actually MRI-guided, so you can actually see the tract. These two little tracts that you see, that's actually the fiber that's being placed in the tumor. So now, similar to what I mentioned in the beginning about radiation oncology treatment planning, right? Now you can actually get a sense as to where to place the fiber, how many fibers to place, what's the best way to actually successfully illuminate the entire tumor. So this is now imaging. In fact, this is actually work done in my lab. One of my med students from a couple of years ago, she did this. It's actually published. It's not 2016. So anything, obviously, I'm going to show a lot of research and clinical data. If there's anything you guys are curious about, feel free to reach out to me as well. I'll be happy to share that with you. We've also utilized this to monitor PDT in real time, and this is something that we're trying to move to the clinic as well. Again, these images project really poorly, but this is in an animal model. These are big, bulky, had a squamous cell carcinoma is actually in the leg muscle of mice, and I don't know, you can't see it here, but there's actually a fiber there that's going in. Again, reiterating what I just mentioned before. And then the other advantage is also in real time, you could monitor exactly what PDT is doing. So here's an example. So this is actually in that same study where we had fiber injected or inserted into the tumor to see what just the fiber insertion alone does versus what kind of a response does adding the sensitizer plus the light plus the fiber does. And you can see a lot more change in the tumor post. This is actually showing areas of necrosis. And these are all functional MR imaging methods. So now we're trying to use imaging as a tool to guide the fiber placement and to actually map out the early tissue response, tumor response to PDT. We've also done real-time monitoring. This is, again, a preclinical study that was done years ago where we actually have, and this is something that we would like to do in the clinic hopefully in the future, is real-time. So as I mentioned, it's a light treatment. So when the patient's getting, in this case, for example, these were rats with tumors, and that you can vary so many different things in the treatment parameters. You can vary the amount of light you deliver, you can vary the duration, you can vary the rate at which you deliver, which influences the duration. Here is an image. These are MRI maps, functional T2 maps, as we call them, of two different rats getting two different laser light exposures. This is a lower exposure of the energy, the light energy, and this is much higher. And as you can see, the time varies. This is given in 6 minutes versus 60 minutes. But we actually, this animal, we have a dedicated MR scanner for preclinical research. So these rats were actually getting treated and imaged at the same time. So that's why you're able to get data sets before treatment, a minute and a half into treatment, 3 minutes, and so on and so forth, all the way up to 60 minutes of treatment. So now you have a real-time monitoring system, and this could potentially also be done in the clinic, is to, as these treatment is being done, why is that important? Because it's important, as I mentioned, early on to see whether or not the tumor is responding. In this case, this tumor was a lot more responsive to the treatment than this tumor on the top. Okay, so that's for MRI. So we're going to move on, switch gears, and go to positron emission tomography, or PET, as you may have heard it. Slightly different in terms of how it, the biophysical basis, as I said before, for this is. In PET, unlike MRI, you actually have a compound or a tracer, as we call it, a radionuclide that's injected into the system, into the body. And when this radionuclide actually decays, you actually have a positron that's emitted. And typically, these positrons travel very short distance before they actually interact or annihilate with an electron in the tissue. And what you then end up forming are these two gamma rays that are detected by the scanner. And so basically, when that collision happens, you have these back-to-back gamma rays. And so in the simplest sense, the gantry. So MR has the magnetic field. And one of the things I was going to say, I know some of you said you've undergone an MR before. Did you hear a loud noise when you were undergoing that imaging? That's the great, what we call the gradients. That's the gradients varying the magnetic field. Within that main magnetic field, you have these additional gradients that are varying. In this case, you have detectors. You have PET scanner has a surrounding, essentially a ring of detectors that's picking up those gamma rays. So you have multiple rings, and of course, these detectors are registering those hits, and then by collecting a whole bunch of these hits, it's able to basically tomographically pair those events and reconstruct and give you a cross-sectional image of exactly what that, in that point in space, what the tracer concentration was. And unlike MR, as I mentioned, there are a lot of radionuclides that are used. The most common one, of course, is glucose, FDG, 18-FDG specifically. And this is typically, this is probably one of the widely used tracers in PET imaging. The principle is the same with the added biological mechanism being when you inject these radio-labeled, essentially this is radio-labeled glucose, when you inject it in metabolically active cells, which most tumors tend to be, it's actually taken up by these glucose transporters, and where they then, it undergoes phosphorylation into glucose 6-phosphate. But unlike the parent glucose 6-phosphate, this FDG 6-phosphate cannot be metabolized further, so it actually becomes trapped in the cells, which then leads us to detect it as what we call a hot spot, and I'll show you examples of that in a second. So there are lots of tracers, as I mentioned before. I'm not going to ask you on the half-life of some tracer. Again, in terms of the test itself, it's going to be testing concepts and applying the knowledge, not memorizing and regurgitating numbers and values. So here's an example of what I just mentioned. So this is actually in a patient with laryngeal cancer. This is actually a CT image, and this is a PET image. Remember at the beginning I pointed out that PET has a low spatial resolution. What do I mean by that? This is a CT image that's showing all the parts. That's a hyoid bone. That's a part of the tumor. There's actually a node. You can actually see some of the vessels. If you take this out of the equation, if you were to just look at this, there's no way for you to know what anatomically what that is. Right? That's what I mean by spatial resolution. So the MR image, even without contrast, if I showed you a certain image, after training, of course, you'll be able to say, okay, you know what? That example of the mouse that I showed you, for example, you see the two eyes and the brain, you have some idea of localization in terms of where you're at. PET, you get a signal because you don't have a lot of other areas that are going to give you that radioactive signal that you're getting. It's a big hot spot. Other brain will also light up. Metabolically active tissues will light up. But it has a very poor spatial resolution. And so a lot of studies actually, particularly in the last couple of years, I've moved towards PET CT co-registered imaging. So CT has a higher resolution, computer tomography, and you can co-register that, which is what you're seeing here. Now if you actually localize, you can better get an idea where is this PET hotspot actually located at. Here's an example of a preclinical study this time, looking at a receptor expression. Remember I mentioned the idea of molecular imaging is to look at processes, biological processes. So here they are looking at, instead of glucose, they made this radioactive tracer that's basically the vascular endothelial growth factor. So now you have a readout as to what the VEGF-driven tumors, which most tumors tend to be, how much of the tumor is actually receptor expression, for example, how much is actually there. So when you actually look at just the radioactive dye. Without the VEGF, with the targeted VEGF, it's actually supposed to be a tumor there. You see some enhancement, but nothing remarkable. But now in this mouse, which has the tumor, and then you inject it post this with this targeted VEGF-labeled radioactive tracer, you can now see the avidity of that particular tracer. Now you have a contrast agent that's targeted to the particular, in this case, VEGF. Obviously, as you can see, their liver takes up a lot of tissue. You get a lot of uptake in the liver based on the composition, the chemistry of the contrast agent. The biodistribution varies. Clinically, there's also been applied, for example, in this case, this is actually in prostate cancer, looking at androgen receptor. So prostate cancers, a lot of them initially at least, and in most stages, are driven by androgens. Testosterone is an example. In this case, they had a radioactive testosterone. And basically the principle behind this is if you had an unbound receptor, the androgen receptor, you're going to likely to get a high PET signal post-injection of this agent, whereas if you treated that patient with anti-androgen therapy and it was actually successful, you will not be able to, because this radio-labeled testosterone won't be able to bind to that receptor, you would get a much lower signal. And then by looking at the MDV-3100 is a form of anti-androgen therapy. And so they looked at the percent change in the signal in a series of patients to see how it correlated with the PSA, which is a biochemical marker of prostate cancer. And as you can see, this is what we call waterfall plots. Individual patients, going back to my previous point, you could look at these patients. In this case, they actually did both FDG and the testosterone. The uptake patterns, what they found was they could actually, this is again, early pilot study, showing that perhaps there's a utility for radio-labeled dihydrotestosterone, which is probably more indicative of response than FDG PET. Another way of looking at it is another target, in this case PSMA, prostate-specific membrane antigen, the idea being the same. If you were to actually target this particular marker in prostate cancer, if you had a low PSMA, if there's high AR activity and low PSMA, you get a lower signal. Whereas if it was the other way around, your PET signal would be much more stronger. Again, the same idea. If your anti-androgen therapy is working, you should get a much, if that's being successful, you should get a much more stronger signal on the PET scan. Again, these are anecdotal examples of what the clinical work is going on in the field of functional imaging with PET. Now we'll move on to optical. So we've covered MR and PET. Optical imaging, as the name implies, relies on light. And so before we talk about optical imaging as a whole, here's a recap of what you guys probably have seen before, the electromagnetic spectrum, right? Varying wavelengths of light. One of the reasons why optical imaging has actually caught on in the last, certainly it's been around for a long time, but certainly in the last decade or so, there's been a lot of clinical interest in that, is unlike CT or PET, it does not involve ionizing radiation. So it's light, but a varying wavelength, but it's still light, and it's therefore a lot more safer from a patient's perspective. I'm sure all of you will agree that if it was a choice between an MRI or a CT versus a flashlight, you would pick the flashlight option, right? Look at it in that sense, and it's very simple, just in terms of clinical applicability and making sure that patient compliance is higher. So it's obviously a lot safer. It can give you images, can give you reasonable good contrast, as I'll show you. And it's also quantitative, but the biggest advantage with these optical imaging methods is that they're quick, typically in seconds to minutes. Whereas an average MRI scan, even for the simplest of scans, right, you set up the gantry, patient goes into the gantry, set up scans, localizer, et cetera, we're talking 20, you know, anywhere from 15 minutes. I'm sure your peer can address to this, 5 minutes in a scanner feels like eternity, right? As opposed to, think of it, again, this is as a young adult. Think of a cancer patient. You're already going through the trauma that you've got a diagnosis of cancer. Then you say, oh, go into the CT for this treatment plan and go into a PET scanner. Go, as opposed to saying, you know what? You know, Mr., you know, John Doe would say, okay, how about I just take a minute of your time, I want to image this tumor, and then you're free to go. So patient compliance is obviously a big factor. And because these are short, these are repeatable as well. So in fact, I have a protocol that should hopefully start accruing patients in a couple of months, which is trying to do some repeat optical imaging in patients before and after therapy. Again, the idea of non-invasive imaging is consistent throughout, right? It doesn't change across the modalities. Okay, as I mentioned at the beginning, there are caveats to each of these methods. In optical imaging, of course, because it's relying on light, depth becomes an issue. So depending on what you want to image or where the location of that lesion is, and this is an example to show that, depending on the wavelength going from blue to red near IR, obviously blue light has very limited penetration, and a lot of the studies you'll see are either in the near IR longer wavelengths because you have a better penetration. You can also get a lot of background scattering because there are a lot of things in tissue that are optically active and can contribute to your background. Unlike PET, which I showed you, nothing else, you don't have circulating levels of radioactive glucose in your body, right? So whatever is lighting up is really coming from what you injected. Whereas with optical imaging, you get a lot of background, so that's always going to be an issue. And as I mentioned, signal attenuation. So there's something called the optical window based on the fact that a lot of these, so these are examples of all the optically active molecules in tissue. So hemoglobin, depending on whether it's oxygenated or deoxygenated, has a different absorption coefficient. Melanin, water, lipids, et cetera, they all have. So the idea is you want to be maximizing contribution from that molecule that you're relying on contrast while minimizing the other molecules that are giving contrast. We'll talk about two things particularly relevant for research. Some of you might already be using these techniques or might intend to, or perhaps will end up using these in your research. We'll talk about fluorescence imaging and bioluminescence imaging. The commonality between the two is that they're both based on light emission characteristics. They both use a camera of some sort, CCD, to collect the photons. But there are differences in what the principle is and the sensitivity and specificity. And unlike the methods I showed you, MR, CT, you can get three-dimensional volume renderings of your tissue of interest. Most optical imaging, although tomography is possible, is typically planar. It's typically 2D. You just view it from one plane. So there are obviously advantages and limitations, and we'll talk about that. One of the reasons why optical imaging, particularly in the research realm, in the arena, has exploded is because you have a lot of optical molecules, reporters, and dyes, and proteins. You can actually readily label your cells of interest, your tissues of interest, your cancer cells. You can label them with your favorite type of protein or even a certain process that's driving the cancer. And we'll talk about those in detail. Okay, let's talk about bioluminescence imaging. How many of you have actually used or heard of bioluminescence imaging? Okay, so in all probability, like I said, a lot of you are PhD students, I take it, or most of you are. So you might end up using this in your in vivo work. If you end up working with animals, looking at tumor growth or treatment response, et cetera, in the simplest sense, bioluminescence imaging, you don't really require an external light for excitation, but it really relies on a biochemical reaction, a chemiluminescence reaction that occurs when you have a certain substrate that you deliver, which undergoes enzymatic reaction, and I'll give you the specifics in a second. The advantage is, this is high throughput. Unlike the other methods, it's cheaper. For example, we have, in my lab and in the shared resource, we have imaging systems dedicated for this. You can image up to 5 animals at a time, as opposed to MR when you're doing one by one. So there's sensitivity is high, throughput is high, imaging times are short. So this is one of the reasons why it's actually widely used in research, not just cancer research. And I mentioned the biochemical reaction. The biochemical reaction that is actually happening is your substrate, your luciferin substrate, is reacting. So the way it works is you take your typical cell line of interest, your cancer cell line, and you have a bioluminescent reporter transgene that you put that's typically driven by some promoter. This is a lot of times it's a constitutive promoter. CMV is often used, but you could also have it under your favorite promoter if you wanted to see specific driving. Drivers of that cancer, and this you have your cells transfected with. And when you have a tumor that's formed by these cells, and then inject the animal with the substrate, this then interacts, the substrate reaches the tumor, interacts with the luciferase protein, And that's a light-emitting reaction. So you end up forming this oxy-luciferin and also that biochemical reaction. There are ways to increase the sensitivity of that reaction, get more photons. You could have, you could do so many different things. You could do a synthetic intron. There are a couple other things. There are even different kinds of substrate, luciferin being the most widely used. But you could use different sources of luciferase, firefly or ranilla. But just in the simplest sense, it is a biochemical reaction that occurs. And of course, you would need this, your cells of interest to actually have this luciferase tag on them. So here's an example. Here's what the system looks like. You have, this is all in K's, and of course, a lot of these systems also do fluorescence imaging, so you have a whole series of filters in them. And so I mentioned it's used widely in preclinical oncology, and here is some, it's just a summary of what they're used for. You can study tumor growth, particularly in tumors that are not visible to the eye, so orthotopic tumor models. If you had a tumor growing in the brain, the liver, maybe breast, mammary fat pad, prostate, you could now longitudinally track that disease growth. You could look at drug efficacy, therapeutic responsiveness. You could look at, as I mentioned, you could have a specific gene of interest that you want to study, whether that's actually driving your cancer, or what is the change in this particular gene over time as the cancer grows. So these can also be used, bioluminescence can be used for that as well. And of course, as a part of that tumor progression, you could look at metastatic dissemination and pattern of disease progression in these. So I'll give you some examples of that. Here's an example. This is, in fact, the company Caliper PerkinElmer Corporation actually had, they sell these commercially, these cell lines are commercially available. Any tumor cell line that you're working in, any tumor site, breast, lung, prostate, you name it, they probably have already a transfected cell line that they have. They're expensive, but you can measure, you then have these cells, you grow them, you inject these animals, and over time you can actually see the growth of that tumor using this bioluminescence imaging technique. This is, of course, a co-registration with CT, trying to actually see where the anatomy is. Of course, with optical imaging, because it also captures an image of the animal, even though the optical signal, similar to the PET, doesn't have a lot of resolution, you still get you get to know where your signal is localized. Here's an example. This is, in this case, it's actually a leukemia. It's a hematologic malignancy. You inject these cells either via tail vein, or you want to just track. You don't know where it's actually going to seed and grow. This is four different views of the same animal over time, week 1, 2, 3. You can see by week 4, for example, there's extensive disease. So this is something that you won't, obviously that you will know by this time this is a sick mouse, but now it's giving you a quantitative visual and a quantity. You can quantify this as the total photon count, but it's giving you an idea as to the pattern of dissemination. So if you had a drug that's working and you don't know if it's going to work against, you could then essentially treat these animals and see if the disease burden that you measured here actually changed or not. You can also, of course, validate it by opening it up after if you want to measure that. You can also do an ex vivo quantification of the disease burden as well. So as with optical imaging techniques, most optical imaging techniques, there are caveats to it. The luciferase itself is a variable in the equation, so the stability of the luciferase in your cells, you want to make sure your transfection works, and there's also work that's been done to identify some really potent, highly stable and high output luciferases. One of the things I mentioned in the MR and the PET contact that the tracer is injected systemically, same thing with this, but there are studies that have looked at local intratumoral administration, which obviously would not be very useful in all kinds of tumors or even subcutaneous administration. So the route of administering your substrate, the luciferin, has a major impact on your signal. When after you image, just like the kinetic data that I showed you with MR, and I didn't show you the kinetics with PET, but with MRI, as I mentioned, the kinetics makes a difference as to what that curve looks like. For BLI, again, that kinetics makes a big difference on what your signal is. So here's an example between the three different routes, IP versus subcutaneous injection versus IV, all in the same. You can immediately see the distribution is different with the same tumor in the animal, but the amount of luciferin that's being distributed post-injection has a big difference, where IV and SC are not picking up some of the lesions, you're now actually seeing a lot more activity in other sites. Here's just another image. In fact, even positioning of the animal has, because these are planar images, how you position also has an influence on the BLI signal. The point that I just made, the kinetics, as I mentioned before, the temporal enhancement kinetics vary depending on whether it's given IV, SC, or IP. So the peak time, you can see the curves are completely different whether you administer the luciferin IP or SC. So that has to be kept in mind as well. Okay, so I mentioned bioluminescence. Another imaging method is fluorescence imaging, which is similar to what I mentioned, except you inject a fluorophore or a fluorescent dye, which now actually, when you excite that dye by shining light, you know, with the wavelength specific for the dye, the fluorophore then gets excited and then returns through multiple processes. But that fluorescent light, when one of the processes, when it but the decay results is in an emission of light or fluorescence, which is then picked up by the CCD camera. Of course, with the appropriate filters, as I mentioned before, background fluorescence is an issue. Depending on what the wavelength you're operating, the optical window, this is why the longer wavelengths are chosen, and also non-overlapping. You want spectra of your proteins of interest or your tumor cells to be distinct from other regions that might fluoresce in that same wavelength. So a lot of work has been shifted to near-infrared fluorophores. And there's also something called multispectral imaging, which I'll give you an example of, which is trying to get the spectral data from each of those wavelengths so you can tease out what's really background versus what's coming from the tumor, for example. So there's also use for this in the microscopy world, fluorescence microscopy. You could have an antibody against any target of interest. In this case, for example, this is fluorescence imaging of tumor vessels, two different dyes, in fact. You can actually see this is CD31 overlaid, looking at quantification. This is in tumor sections treated with either vehicle or drug one, drug two, or combination, quantifying the number of functioning tumor vessels with two different markers. CD31 is a marker for blood vessels. NG2 is actually covering the pericytes or the perivascular cells. And you can now get a quantification based on the fluorescence of these dyes in tissue sections, the extent of perfusion or functional blood vessels. You can also, so there are some drugs that are also fluorescent. This is doxorubicin, for example. This is a study which, again, these are studies, examples of studies done in my lab where we looked at quantifying the amount of doxorubicin in the tumor without treating it with another drug or a drug that disrupts the blood vessels to see if we can increase drug delivery. And we saw that we can increase the drug delivery if we disrupt the vessels of the tumor. So now you're actually imaging the drug itself. Albeit ex vivo, you can also do this in vivo in the mouse using fluorescence. You can also, same idea, you can also look at tumor characteristics like vascular maturation and drug delivery. In this case, you're looking at multiple fluorescent dyes, different wavelengths. This is actually an image of control tumors and drug-treated tumors. This is combining the doxorubicin fluorescence and the vascular dyes. So now you can actually measure how much of the drug actually reached the tumor, the whole tumor, and also as a spatial function of distance from the blood vessel. So for example, this is the fluorescent intensity of, so you're measuring the total dox concentration based on fluorescence. You can now, because these are co-registered images with the blood vessels, you can now measure what is your drug concentration as a function of distance from the vessel wall. So you can actually trace, you can drop a line and get a line profile as to how much drug is there. As you would expect, of course, as you go further and further away from a blood vessel, your concentration drops. I mentioned multispectral imaging. This is essentially acquiring multiple wavelength data, but you can split them up because the spectra are all different. Here, I'll give you specific examples. I gave you examples of ex vivo microscopy, but you can also do this in vivo with either green fluorescent protein that's in the 500 wavelength or red that's just further out. You can measure tumors in sub-Q or in the prostate or in the brain, for example, or any other site in the body. You can, as I mentioned before, there's a laundry list of tracers that are available commercially to pick your target of interest, your molecule of interest even. In cancer, you have agents that target matrix metalloproteinases, you have cathepsin-targeted agents, you have integrin targeted contrast agents. Essentially, for every pathology, there's been dyes that have been developed that tag to a particular molecule of interest. And this multispectral example I gave you, you can do it in vivo as well. And that's what they did in the study, where they injected this animal with quantum dots. These are optical dyes with varying wavelengths. And you can then actually see, if you inject it into the foot pad of these animals or the ears, the lymphatic drainage of these regions. So if you had a tumor, as I mentioned, head and neck tumors metastasized to the lungs, you could now actually see which one of the dyes actually localized where. So parts that also get, so if you had both a, for example, red and a yellow, that might end up looking like a co-registered as a green versus just a yellow alone region that's telling you only one of the dyes got there. So now you can actually essentially multiplex or multispectrally get an idea how, if you're injecting two different drugs, are they both getting to the tumor or is only one getting to the tumor? You can also combine the two methods, fluorescence and bioluminescence. This is actually worked on in my lab. This is a mouse with a head and neck tumor that has a luciferase being driven constitutively in these tumor cells. So you know there's a tumor there. We now imaged using fluorescence, and this is actually a dye that's tagged to integrin, so you can actually measure the vascularity of the tumor. There's also a glucose that's optically active. So now you're measuring metabolism, you're measuring tumor growth, and you're measuring perfusion all within the same animal. So that's an advantage, high throughput, preclinically at least. You can essentially use the same idea to look at therapeutic response. This is after treatment with an anti-VEGF agent, looking at either tumor growth, this is a cathepsin-based targeted contrast agent, or this is an integrin, again, vascular marker-based agent. So you can measure the fluorescence of these two wavelengths. After, before and after treatment, here they're showing that post-treatment, you can see the vehicle tumors grew, the vascular tumors didn't grow, and what they saw was there's basically a reduction in blood vessels and the tumor cells. And this is just a co-registered image of the two. You can also use optical imaging to guide procedures, similar to what I showed before. This is in an animal model with a dye. This is cetuximab. It's an antibody against the epidermal growth factor receptor, which is overexpressed in a lot of head and neck cancers. And what you're seeing here is actually showing an animal with a tumor, looking at bright field near infrared when you open the skin. And if you were to just do a partial resection and when you inject the dye, you can still see that there's tumor left behind. Now you can use that to actually recognize that there's still some tumor that we need to take out, then you can actually remove that excessive tumor. This has now actually gone to the clinic. There are studies that have been done, again, early stage studies that are trying to use optical imaging guided surgery in patients. The idea being the same, whether you do it when you do the fluorescence imaging, you get a sense as to what the extent of the tumor is, and then you can actually use this in the OR to resect the tumor, and even ex vivo measure that fluorescence. And once that tumor is excised, that surgical pathology can also give you a readout of what that, in this case, EGFR expression is in the tumor. Again, the same example, intraoperative fluorescence guided. There's actually a surgical device. One of the things that I want to point out with optical imaging, it's actually easily adaptable. So you can actually, speaking of filters, for example, something as simple as just putting a certain filter in the OR lights could be adapted to your clinical use based on what your fluorophore is. So then they didn't measure the margins, they measured the skin, muscle, and the take-home message from this is that they were able to get a successful resection of tumor and able to distinguish it from normal tissue compared to without the dye alone. Okay, the final 15 minutes, I'm going to go through ultrasound. Ultrasound, as a lot of you are probably familiar with, is referring to sound waves that are not detectable by the human ear. Bats, of course, can detect it. If you've ever heard of the term echolocation, it's based essentially on the same principle, or even sonar, the way they map the ocean, the bed. The idea is the same. So you basically have a sound wave. So bats, for example, use that echolocation based on essentially when the sound waves are emitted and they come back, how what's perceived is how they know a target or a particular animal is nearby. Idea is the same with clinical ultrasound. You're utilizing interaction of sound waves with living tissue. And in, of course, in terms of imaging, you're trying to get some idea as to what the tissues look like or the characteristics. I'm sure all of you have seen that classic image of the ultrasound, the pregnant woman and the technician showing the baby, right? You see an ultrasound of the baby, that's what you see. That's typically what you see, right? That's a fetus. You see that child. And immediately off the bat, you can, one of the things that I want to point out is you can see based on MR to CT to optical imaging to ultrasound. Again, ultrasound doesn't have the greatest of resolution. I'll give you some examples to illustrate that point. But this is what a typical ultrasound machine looks like. It's smaller, portable. Essentially, you can, the gantry itself is, this is actually a preclinical system, and this is a clinical system. You have three basic components. You have the transducer that may, that transmits and receives the signal. You have a computer processing that data, and also this image storage unit. We actually have one of these systems here as well. The basic principle is this transducer essentially produces mechanical oscillations. So when you have that transducer, and in this case, the cartoon, so that technician has got that, that's the transducer I'm talking about. You put it in your, it's directed onto the tissue or the object that you want to scan, and when you sweep back and forth, that signal is getting the echoes, the reflections are changed by the composition of the tissue. So you're then detecting that, and it's then transforming it into electrical signals, which your receiver then processes into a, into an image. So the idea being, in the simplest sense, I always use this for you to conceptualize this. You shout at the tumor shouts back at you, right? That's the idea. What is that distribution of that? So that's the return of that echo is what's telling you about that tissue. What influences contrast is, again, similar to light as a function of depth, the characteristic that influences contrast in ultrasound is what we call acoustic impedance, which is basically how quickly can the sound wave transmit through that, which is influenced by the tissue density. And so if you look at most soft tissues, the velocity of that sound transmission is pretty constant, around 15, 40 meters per second. But the tissue density varies. So when you have differences in tissue densities, the sound waves are reflected differently and therefore picked up differently by the transducer. So here's an example between bone and tissue and gas, for example. There's clearly a difference in the transmission of the sound waves. And so the more this mismatch in that interface, in that tissue that you're imaging, the more contrast you're going to get. So the more waves likely to get reflected and returned to the transducer. So examples in terms of the frequency we operate. Clinically, we are typically operating at 3 to 15 megahertz frequencies. For preclinical models, we're a lot higher given the size issues. Here's an example. That's a human. That's a mouse. It's actually a mouse fetus. It's a mouse micro ultrasound, and that's a human fetus. So the resolution that we need is much higher. So the frequency that we operate is actually much higher. So here's an example of the point that I made before. Again, if I didn't have any of these labels, you look at these images and go, you have no idea what I'm talking about. I could be talking about the brain, the abdomen, prostate. Doesn't matter. Back to the first point. Spatial resolution in ultrasound is not that great. There's also a pretty steep learning curve in terms of learning the anatomy. Even technicians, this is why they're trained ultrasound technicians. But it is good for soft tissue imaging, and you can get certain areas of the body are certainly going to give you much better contrast. Again, this projects it even worse than the image itself shows. But you can also do, similar to what I showed you before, you can do anatomic, functional, and molecular imaging. This is actually an ultrasound of the prostate. Similar to other methods, you can do three-dimensional reconstruction to get volumetric data on tumor of interest, prostate, wherever the site is. You can also use contrast-enhancing agents. In this case, these are microbubbles. These are basically lipid shells that contains gas. Typically, these microspheres are what we use to give contrast. Here's an example of contrast enhancement in the kidneys over time. So within 3 seconds, you can see how the contrast is actually filling up in the kidney. This is just a B-mode image, and this is just a enhancement image, again, pseudo-colorized. You can also develop targeted contrast agents for ultrasound, microbubbles. In this case, again, VEGF receptor. Then you can treat the animal, in this case, with an anti-VEGF treatment to see if it actually had an effect. So again, this is within 48 hours when the size may not change dramatically, but the functionality of the vessels is changing. So it's giving you an early readout on the efficacy prior to a manifestation of the volumetric change, clinical manifestation of it. You can, again, do the same kind of pharmacokinetic modeling that I mentioned before. You can get parameters like peak enhancement, wash-in rate, rise time, all of which tell you the functionality. You can do heterogeneity. I mentioned in the beginning, RESIST doesn't give you an insight into the heterogeneity. You can now sample multiple regions within the tumor and look at three different regions, for example, and look at that heterogeneity in the enhancement post-contrast with ultrasound. This is actually a paper looking at carcinogenesis in a transgenic model, going from a normal breast to hyperplastic to carcinoma in situ to invasive breast. They imaged using these VEGF receptor-targeted ultrasound contrast agents, and they saw that their signal went up, and they actually were able to validate it with histology, so potentially as a screening tool for disease progression or even in the prevention setting, there's a utility. And finally, a method that sort of takes a leaf out of the ultrasound is called photoacoustic. It's really a hybrid imaging that combines the ultrasound with optical piece. And the way photoacoustic imaging works is there's an optical component to it where you actually shine light on the tissue of interest, which then results in thermoelastic expansion and then generation of these sound waves. So here's a cartoon to illustrate that point. You have, I guess the movie's not working, but you have an optical path when you have the laser light, it's absorbed, and within the tissue, there's thermoelastic expansion, which generates these pressure waves that are then detected in the acoustic path. Similar to what I mentioned before for fluorophores, you have a lot of endogenous optically active agents. Hemoglobin and hemoglobin oxygen, whether or not it's oxygenated or deoxygenated, influences. There's also dyes that you can use, methylene blue, indocyanine. I'll give you some of the examples. This is actually melanoma, for example. Melanin is another endogenous contrast agent for PA. This is looking at melanoma, and you can actually even see the blood vessels around it. These are preclinical data sets looking at distribution of blood vessels and in the tumor and in the healthy brain. This is more work done in my lab, where we're looking at therapeutic response in a tumor using photoacoustic imaging. So I mentioned before the profile, the absorption, the spectra, the absorption coefficient of hemoglobin is influenced by its oxygenation state. So as you can see, between deoxyhemoglobin and oxygenated hemoglobin, slightly different. So by measuring the signal at both these wavelengths, you can actually now get a measure of oxygen saturation within that tumor, the extent of hemoglobin that's actually, the amount of oxygen that's actually being delivered to the tumor. So now we actually did this in a animal model of head and neck cancer where we actually exposed the animals to carbogen, which is oxygen and carbon dioxide, 5% CO2, and you get a hemodynamic response that increases, particularly in the normal tissue. And then when we do the same repeat experiment 24 hours after treatment with this drug that affects the blood vessels, you see that in the tumor that response is completely abolished. So now you have an early response indicator, photoacoustic imaging-based response indicator of outcome. You can also measure simultaneously. This is another example worked on my lab looking at salivary gland cancer. This is actually a mouse salivary gland. This is the tumor. This is the surrounding normal salivary gland. You can now get oxygen saturation for all these different regions within the tumor and normal tissue. We've also done studies looking at co-registering that with MR. As I mentioned before, this is MRI, this is PA. We've also correlated that with histology. This is where we're heading in the field in some ways is heading as well, is trying to look at, I mentioned early imaging biomarkers. Here's an example. This is a preclinical study looking at response of tumors to radiation, and these are individual tumors in mice. And the idea being, this is 24 hours after radiation treatment, does that change that we detect mean anything in the long-term outcome of these tumors? And so here we're actually correlating that with a change in volume. What we observed was that an early change in oxygen saturation is actually a good thing in terms of radiation efficacy, radiotherapeutic efficacy. And so this is something that we're trying to move to the clinic as well. As with everything else I mentioned, that's all endogenous contrast. You can also use exogenous agents. We're developing nanoparticle-based contrast agents to look at tumors and normal tissue. This is actually intestinal imaging using these nanoparticles that were made in collaboration with one of my collaborators at UB. We've shown that this is safe. We've actually used it to image head and neck tumors, and you can now get the kinetics of the distribution of these agents as well. Again, just to finish off clinically, there's a lot of interest in PA. I have two trials that I hope will start in the next 3 months. here at Roswell looking at photoacoustic imaging. There's a lot of interest in breast and prostate. I'm, of course, interested in head and neck cancer, so we're trying to see if we can start a couple of trials, even in melanoma patients, using this technique. There's some work that's been done. This is actually work done in prostate ex vivo, but not a lot of work. There's a lot of trials that are ongoing to examine that. Okay, to wrap up, let's go back to square one. I know we talked about this, so let's revisit this again. What is this? Are we staying with the same? Are we changing our minds? What do you think that first one is? What did you say it was before? MRI? That is correct. Second one? There are no points for this. It's okay to say the wrong answer. What do you think the second one is? Of all the things, if you're going to stall it, that's not the one you're going to stall it, right? What does that look like? Look like an x-ray to you? We didn't talk about x-rays, but... And then what do you think this is? Guess. Educated guess. It is a fluorescence image. What do you think this is? PET? Good. Last one? That's the exact same image I showed in one of the slides before. So just by cheating, you should have gotten that one. And what do you think this one is? That's actually also an MR image. It's actually a different kind of contrast method, but that's also the same breast image that I showed before. Okay, to reiterate, to get everything back together, the take-home message across the board, multiple imaging methods have strengths and weaknesses, differences in resolution, sensitivity. At least recognize that. Recognize that the limitations are also based on the biophysical basis for contrast, right? So MR versus optical versus PET versus fluorescence or bioluminescence or ultrasound for that matter. Recognize that. And finally, where the field is going is actually now this really exciting area called radiogenomics or even radiomics, which is trying to combine this imaging data with, there's a lot of interest in high throughput technology, right? Microarrays, RNA-seq data, tons of data that's just big data that's just being deposited. The idea being, can we combine or correlate the imaging phenotypes with the genotypes of these tumors to better identify driving pathways, drivers of cancer, back to the goal that I mentioned at the beginning, is to actually then identify the patient population that should be getting a particular targeted therapy. That's where the field is heading. And with that, I will stop and wait for any questions, comments, critiques. Okay, just as I know you have a test coming up soon. I can, at least for my section, I will tell you, I'm not going to say, oh, that table, what is the half-life of this radioactive tracer? That is not going to be the question. It's going to be conceptual. I'm going to maybe ask you to design an experiment using bioluminescence or MRI. So think about it in terms of the big picture, and you should be fine. There is extra credit if you join Ball for Bucks, but I'm kidding. Maybe. Okay, free to go.